It's 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. This is Roger Goldman. Let's see what's in store with our weather. We have a report from Noah Price of the ABC News, News 4 Weather.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. Here's today's weather for the Wasatch Back. We'll see that high pressure continue to dominate over much of the state, and that'll lead to another warm one for today with calm winds. We'll see plenty of sunshine, and just a few clouds are possible along the Wasatch Back. We'll see those temperatures warming into the low 50s, and then as we head into the overnight hours for tonight, we'll see temperatures cooling off into the upper 20s and low 30s, just below freezing, and seeing light winds once again. Those calm winds will persist going into Saturday with few more clouds increasing as we head later in the day, but temperatures will be on the warmer side once again, warming up into the low 50s, and then going into Sunday again, more warm temperatures, increasing clouds, but we'll see those highs into the low 50s, looking to high of around 52 into Park City. And then going into next week, we'll see those lows again, just dipping down into the mid to low 30s with a few upper 20s, but otherwise seeing warmer temperatures once again for Monday into Tuesday with highs into the low 50s. And then precip chances will increase as we head into the middle of next week. We are watching a weak storm system that could be bringing rain and a snow mix, especially into those higher elevations where you could be expecting some more snow. But again, temperatures are going to be a little bit warmer into the valley area, so we'll see those highs still into the mid to upper 40s. And then by Thursday, we should see highs cooling off into the low 40s. And we'll be expecting more snow showers going into the middle of next week into those higher elevations. And yeah, we could be expecting some light snow accumulations, but again, still a little too early to make any determinations on snowfall amounts, especially into those mountain ranges. I know a lot of skiers and snow lovers are eager to see more snow, especially the ski resorts, but we'll stay tuned for that. And from the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Noah Price.
Let's see what this weather bodes for the in the mountains. Here with a report, we have the Utah Avalanche Center. I think we got Drew. Morning, Drew.
Hey, good morning. You know, they'd never hire me to be on the marketing department for the current conditions of the backcountry. They're pretty rough and rugged, hard as a rock right now. They'll soften up, and then it'll be, as I would describe, a sort of stop-and-go mashed potatoes with the warming spring-like temperatures here. And as we just heard, it's only going to get warmer over the course of the weekend. We just have a pretty thin and threadbare snowpack, just 1 to 2 feet of snow up high. And the only cold snow that exists is along the higher reaches of the north-facing aspects, and that's fairly wind damaged. The avalanche conditions, I'm calling it pockets of moderate for triggering a soft slab sitting on our old faceted grains, our persistent weak layer of faceted grains from early season. If you just pull out your shovel and dig to the bottom of the snowpack on the northerly aspects, you'll just see that coarse rock salt at the base of the pack. That's trending towards low, but I'm just calling it pockets of moderate. It seems unlikely, but not impossible to trigger one of these avalanches that would be 1 to 2 feet deep. On the other side of the compass, generally, we do have problems of wet avalanches, and those will spike with daytime warming and, again, with increasing temperatures over the course of the weekend. That should be, I can't say if they're record-breaking or not, but seeing it +6 centigrade at 700 millibars up high, that's just something to shake your head at. So stay tuned. Again, the danger is going to rise to moderate for wet avalanches on the solar aspects. And again, pockets of moderate for triggering a soft slab on the PWL, as we say. You can get all this information and more, as always, at UtahAvalancheCenter.org.
So, Drew, if you look here in downtown Park City, if you look around, there's no snow here. How high do you have? I'm listening to you talk about avalanche danger, and I'm thinking, how high do you have to get to actually find some snow? I mean, where are you seeing those pockets?
Those pockets have generally been at around 9,300 feet and higher on the north to northeast facing aspects. I mean, there was a widespread avalanche cycle in the upper reaches of the Cottonwood Canyons, in the upper reaches of the Ogden area mountains, and certainly down in Provo, widespread cycle. I mean, just the walls came down with that storm last weekend. Mm-hmm. It was wet, windy, wild, and so forth. But you got to be in the highest elevations and generally the north to northeast facing aspects. But things are stabilizing. I think they're on a good trend, but we need more snow. That's no secret to anybody.
Yeah, I don't think anybody listening to this broadcast who is looking for a ski season is very excited. So hopefully things will turn around eventually, but it's going to be a while, I'm afraid.
They always do. Okay, we'll see you later.
Thanks, Drew. Coming up, Leslie Thatcher got to speak with Sundance Film Festival senior programmer John Nine about some of the films to watch for in this year's Sundance Film Festival. Then council member and mayor-elect Ryan Dickey will stop by with a debrief from last night's Park City Council meeting. We'll finish our hour by speaking with USA Luge Director of Marketing and Sponsorship, Gordy Shear. Let's do a little bit of local news. Western Summit County residents will pay slightly more on their property taxes next year. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports Basin Recreation raised taxes 5%, but still needs to finalize its budget.
Basin Recreation will not raise property taxes as much as previously thought. Wednesday, the Summit County Council voted 4-1 to approve a 5% increase rather than the 15% the district initially proposed. Councilmember Chris Robinson, who made the motion to approve a reduced tax increase, indicated a smaller increment is wise to account for inflation.
That's not the justification that's been primarily given for the tax increase. It's been to add full-time equivalents and to do other things, full-time physicians and to do other things. But there certainly has been an erosion of the district's purchasing power.
The inflation point was what won over Council Vice Chair Canis Hart, who said the week prior he would not vote for the 15% increase. Councilmember Roger Armstrong, meanwhile, walked back his previous support for the full tax. Robinson initially proposed a 10% rate. Armstrong asked him to amend it to 5.
I woke up this morning, and after I think the lead story on the radio, I looked at Beth and said, I can't do this. And that was the Affordable Care Act. Is the subsidy is going to expire soon, and some people are going to see doubling of their health care budgets.
The council was supposed to vote on the increase a week earlier, but was deadlocked after residents spoke out against it. Some said the tax represented expanding optional services that people outside of Basin Rec's taxing boundaries also use. That's as opposed to taxes that go toward law enforcement and emergency response. Basin Rec has said it's experiencing increased insurance, trails, and maintenance costs. The full tax would have also covered a full-time accountant, strategic planner, recreation coordinator, and a marketing position, as well as a few part-time staff. Robinson, who missed the previous meeting, also thought Basin Rec would likely need to issue property tax bonds to pay for the new field house proposed next to Jeremy Ranch Elementary School. Council Chair Tanya Hansen said that was a key reason she voted against even the reduced tax increase Wednesday.
If this tax were going to affect, and then in 3 to 5 years, you want to put a bond on the ballot, that's going to be tough. That's going to be a tough, tough sell.
Robinson says Basin Rec accounts for about 10% of his property taxes. A 15% increase would have amounted to an extra $6.10 annually per $100,000 of taxable property value. So 5% cuts it back to about $2. The Recreation District will need to bring a revised budget to the council next week for approval. It needs to be approved this year, and December 17th is the Summit County Council's final meeting of 2025. Summit County and Basin Rec are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the annual Park City Sunday's annual Holiday Bazaar opens this week for shoppers still looking for just the right gifts. KPCW's Sydney Weaver has a look at what locals can expect.
The 3-day holiday market will feature 80 vendors at the Doubletree Yarrow Hotel in Park City. Park Silly Sunday Executive Director Kate McChesney says many vendors are local.
We've got a lot of local Park City, a lot of Wasatch back in Heber, tons of Eastside, Camas, everything from potters and jewelers, photographers. We've got baked goods, chocolate goods, lots of art.
The free market will also feature balloon tires, puppies from Nuzzles, and photos with Santa.
We'll have free photos with St. Nick, Little St. Nick, which is, we like to call him, our hot buff Santa. And he'll be there the whole weekend, so you can just bring your own camera, snap some pictures for you and your family, get your Christmas cards together.
The Silly Holiday Bazaar is open Friday from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
Sundance has released its lineup of films for this year's festival in Park City. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher sat down with senior programmer John Nine to talk about some of the local films at Park City's final Sundance Film Festival.
The slate of films for the final Sundance Film Festival to be held in Park City was announced Wednesday. On the phone with a preview of what to expect in January is Senior Programmer and Director of Strategic Initiatives, John Nine. Good morning, John.
Hi, Leslie.
So, John, how many total films are in the festival this year? I mean, is it a number smaller than we've seen, like, say, compared to 2019, 2020?
It's probably a tad bit smaller than 2019, 2020. It's almost exactly the same as it was last year. And it's the same, you know, arrangement of film sections.
All right. So what was the level of interest from the filmmaker community? I mean, did you get any indication that filmmakers may be anxious to show their film in the last Utah Sundance Film Festival? Or conversely, are there people dreaming of having a film in the first Boulder, Colorado festival?
I think the sentiment that we've heard expressed repeatedly and throughout, it's not just the people who have a film and who want to screen it, it's the people who want to be there and who are planning to come whether they have a film or not. And I think that's been the most heartening thing is that just talking to producers, filmmakers, veterans who've been coming, industry veterans who've been coming for years, I think we are all really wonderfully touched by the fact that everybody wants to be there. And that's what we're hearing consistently in all the conversations that we have.
All right. So are there any films with Utah connections? I see a documentary called The Lake describing its subject as an environmental nuclear bomb looms over Utah.
Yeah, that's a film that no doubt will have relevance for the Salt Lake City community. It's a local filmmaker, and it is a film that looks at the environmental concerns relating to the Great Salt Lake. It's a fascinating film, and I think what it does a really great job of, and I hope that as we always look for these films to start a conversation, it does a great job of bringing out the complexity of all of this, and that there's no easy solution. There's no easy way of looking at this. And I think in bringing out the various constituents that, you know, relate to the story, it just shows how complicated it is. And I guess, you know, one thing too, noting that not only are we looking to engage Utahns with subject matter that's interesting to them, but reflecting on the legacy of Redford and that environmental storytelling was something that had always been important to him, and it's been an important part of our tradition of showing films that deal with environmental concerns.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about that legacy later, though, but there's also a film set for a special Salt Lake premiere called Cookie Queens, also a documentary about selling Girl Scout cookies?
It is. It's a documentary about Girl Scout cookies, and it's really incredible. You will not be shocked to learn that these kids are adorable. But what I think what's really incredible is that you also see how entrepreneurial they are, how self-aware they are, even as so far as to reflect on the nature of ambition itself with like real maturity for quite young people. So it profiles a bunch of different girls who are selling cookies, and there's so much personality and humor. And as I said, self-reflection, it's really kind of a fascinating film.
All right. So what's your assessment of the 2026 Sundance slate? I mean, did any overarching visions or themes emerge for you?
Yeah, one thing that we've talked about a lot in noticing it is that, and maybe it's notable because we often have a reputation for playing films that have difficult subject matter. This year is a year where comedy is a really, really prevalent part of the program. And what's interesting is, yes, you have comedies that are really funny and kind of outright comedies. David Wayne has a film called Gail Dougherty and the Celebrity Sex Pass. There's a film called The Gallerists, which is very funny, has a satirical edge around the art gallery world. But what's really, I think, amazing is that some of these comedies are dealing with really uneasy subject matter, difficult subject matter, even, you know, in some cases, loss and grief in a really funny way. And an example I would use is Olivia Wilde's film called The Invite, which is about two couples who have a dinner together, a seemingly innocuous dinner. And it really is a throwback to the cinema of kind of classic cinema of marital strife, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or Scenes from Marriage, if it was really, really funny. And it's a really, you know, it's a film that deals with the kind of disintegrating marriage in a way that's very funny, very honest, very true to character. And there are other films like that that I think, you know, get into difficult subject matter. We love a film in competition called Hachan, Shake Your Booty, which is really, you know, sort of creative, formally inventive, funny, and it's dealing with someone who's overcoming the loss of a partner. So that was one thing that we point out, is just that there's so many films that find humor in the least obvious places.
How many submissions did you get this year?
It was around just over 16,000. I don't have the exact number. That, of course, includes short films as well. You know, it, I think, reflects the continued sort of flourishing of independent storytelling and artists who are interested in telling their stories their way.
So what do you think this year's films say about where independent cinema is right now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a little bit what I said, which is that, you know, this is a time, and folks who follow the industry will recognize this. It's a time where there are some real challenges in terms of the independent space, and movies going into distribution and general release. And yet at the same time, you know, the hallmark of this festival has always been the originality and individuality of the films. And they're abundantly present in this program. And, you know, when you sort of look at this industry right now, and you see how valued creativity and personal voice and expression is, and that's what's in this program, right? We sort of said creativity doesn't require a budget, although I'm sure it's nice when they have some money to work with. But the kind, you know, the comedic writing in some of this, the creativity, the way that you watch a film and you say, I have never seen this before, that has real value. And this is a place, Sundance is a place, where that value has shown itself to be of interest to the industry. And, you know, when we look at the industry now and we look at some of the films that we talk about every year in awards, a lot of those people are people who came through Sundance and came through independent storytelling. So it's not just a matter of, oh, does this movie sell or does that movie sell? It's what are the careers that are launched? And I guess, you know, in a year when we're looking at the legacy of the festival, look at that list of how many films, how many filmmakers have come to light because of work that they've shown at Sundance.
Yeah. How have technological changes, AI tools, virtual productions, new exhibition formats impacted what you're seeing from filmmakers today?
Yeah, well, and that's where you really see a time capsule of that over the history of Sundance, because let's remember, you know, you would be looking in the early 2000s at digital technology, right, which arguably had a huge democratizing factor in terms of people being able to make films for much less money. And there was certainly, a sort of kind of expression that came out of that. And then you see that continued into the present. And, you know, there are films, in fact, there are films in the program that really explicitly bring up questions around AI. There are two films, actually. One is called The AI Doc, or How I Became an Apocaloptimist. And one called Ghost in the Machine. The AI Doc is really interesting because it frames the entire project as a question of competing, you know, sort of values, and it forms it as a way that we can try to wrap our head around what AI means. And that's really sort of baked into the form of the film, which is why I love the apocaloptimist term, obviously referencing both optimism and apocalypse in the same breath, and that's really what the film does.
If you would review some of the films then in that legacy program, and can you kind of tell us what directors or actors may return for their films? I mean, is Abigail Breslin, All Grown Up, coming back for Little Miss Sunshine?
She is. And actually, Little Miss Sunshine is going to have a fantastic entourage. They're still working out everyone who's going to be there, but I know Paul Dano and Greg Kinnear are also going to be there. The filmmakers John and Val are going to be there. And it's one of 8 films that we're showing in the Legacy program. That takes place almost entirely during the second half of the festival. We also have House Party, which is a film that I think not everyone knows played at Sundance. It's a fantastic film from the early 90s. Mysterious Skin, which is a Greg Araki film. For those who are genre enthusiasts, we have Saw, which was a Sundance premiere as well. Barbara Kopple's film American Dream. Half Nelson, which is a film that we showed in 2000. It's the 20th anniversary of that film. And then a couple more that we're going to announce. We are still have a few cards up our sleeve. And they are, all the filmmakers are going to be there. And, you know, I think it's one of many things that we're doing around the second half of the festival to try to honor the legacy that we've had in Park City. There will be talks and conversations. We're going to have a special event on the last Friday that really, I think, is a way of bringing together people who have stories about the festival. And we're going to announce more details around that shortly. So we're really looking at that last, you know, 5 days, Tuesday through Friday, in the second half of the festival, as a way of gathering community, as a way of telling stories around the history of the festival, as a way of recognizing the local community. And I think that last event, we're gonna do some of that as well. So, you know, we're still working on it, and I think it's gonna be really great. And like I said at the outset, so many people telling us that they're gonna come this year.
Yeah. Looking ahead real quick, what do you think Boulder, Colorado will bring to the festival that Park City has not, or maybe could not?
Well, I think, you know, look, there's a lot of things that are interesting when you think about moving such a huge cultural event from one place to another. It's not a question necessarily of, you know, transplanting and just literally picking something up and putting it in a new place. You're looking at what it is that that new place, what is it, how does it speak to an artist community? There are a lot of things that we find interesting that we're just starting to dig into, things like, you know, a very prominent university population, and also just, you know, the way that I suppose that you sort of walk around and you say, okay, what does this place suggest? What you know, what would we do differently by virtue of this particular location? And so I think, you know, we try not to be so, not closed-minded, but not necessarily just to think about, okay, well, we did this here, so we're going to do this here. I think we're you know, becoming familiar with the place and thinking about what opportunities it has to offer.
Okay. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Leslie. Take care.
Well, the Park City Council held a regular meeting last night. Here with a debrief is council member and mayor-elect Ryan Dickey. Morning, Ryan.
Good morning, Roger.
That sounds a lot better. Thanks for being here, Ryan. Okay, let's talk about some of the things you heard last night. I take it you heard a staff report about some capital needs for the golf course. Did council tee off on it, or did they find a receptive audience?
Great question. We did talk about the golf course. This came back for a second or third time. You know, the golf course has capital needs. The big one is the irrigation system.
How old is that system now?
I think it dates back to the 90s,
yeah.
And that's a patch on a system from the first 9 holes, I think, were 1964, and then they added the second 9 holes in the 70s. So it's an older course, but, I mean, you know, a much-loved course. It's still hard to get a tee time. Has great reviews. So we love that golf course. So you have, there's kind of two pieces. There's the irrigation system, which is a must-do because we've asked the golf as an enterprise fund to carry its burden for water costs. So that's now built into your greens fees. And then there are sort of upgrades to the course itself when you're talking about tees and fairways and bunkers. You know, not simple upgrades for players. We had deterioration of a lot of those elements of the golf course. And the golf is an enterprise fund, so they have a reserve of about $3 million. And all these capital investments total up to about $5.5. They need to keep a little reserve. So basically, they're $3 million short.
Sure.
To cover all of these upgrades to the course. So I think it'll fall on the next council as part of their capital budgeting project ultimately to say, are we doing the irrigation system and calling it good, it's a muni, it's great as is, or are we going more full bore with improvements, which also, you know, sort of weaves into the idea of, do we have to close the course for a season, which would be a tough call to make.
So I looked at the staff report. There were sort of, you know, they sort of ranked them in terms of importance. Is the $5 million, if they got everything they wanted?
Five and a half would
was the whole though,
would yeah. be everything. Now we had a we had a consultant come in with the report. We had these guys from Troon who are they do golf. They came with a lot of analysis and
Troon does golf
and Troon, to get your course to a Troon level, there was a big list and a big number.
Right.
Our golf staff came back and Vaughn, our golf leader, said, hey, we're sort of already doing a lot of this stuff. Some of this is low priority, but that short list that came back is, these are the things, if you really want to make this golf course back to something that feels a little more like new, this is the list.
So let's talk a little bit, take it down a level for people who are not sort of intimately familiar with the concept of the capital financing we're talking about. Okay, the golf course is supposed to support itself essentially through the greens fees.
That's right. It sort of operates like a business. It charges greens fees and puts some of that money into capital reserves and is supposed to operate sort of on its own.
So one would hope that the capital reserve would be big enough, like any sinking fund, you would hope that it would be enough to take on this, and it isn't.
That's
okay.
Right.
Okay. So what are the alternatives that the golf course and the city face for financing the additional $2 or $3 million we're talking about?
Well, there's really a couple things. I mean, it all sort of falls back on the general fund, which is, the taxpayers. That's our mix of sales and property tax. There's two things. You can loan money, which we've done in the past. So the general fund makes a loan, golf pays it back over time. Or you can say, golf is recreation and treat it more like the Mark, where the Mark doesn't fully recover its costs and is subsidized by the general fund. And you could say golf has operated as an enterprise fund, but in this case, we want to make a transfer to upgrade the course from the general fund.
So if you do it as a loan, then the golf course has to generate enough money to not only service its existing expenses, but to pay the loan back. So would that sort of require maybe a look at greens fees again?
It would, and that was one of the insights from Troon, is that we're really, we're sort of not tapping our full potential of what we could charge visitors. But they said, looking at your course, Aspen charges visitors $200 a round on their muni. They said, looking at your course, you kind of have to upgrade the course to justify those prices. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. Now, I couldn't help but sneak onto Google to look at the reviews of the Aspen course and compare them to ours, and we're doing much better. So once again, Park City in the lead. So maybe there's some headroom there to charge visitors a little more without going full bore on the course.
Yeah. And is that something that's going to get looked at next year as you get further into this process?
Yeah, it'll come back as part of the capital budgeting process. So what we funded last night was just a simple RSQ for a landscape architect to do some design work that'll allow us to get costs that then we can use in budgeting. I think we're going to have a really robust capital budgeting process this year, maybe more than we've done in the past.
I was going to ask you about that. Is that one of your goals as mayor, to sort of upgrade the kind of process that you go through in terms of capital?
It really is. In past years, we've paid so much attention to the operating budget, and that's primarily personnel and paperclips, and this is the ongoing operational stuff. And capital has been a couple $100 million of rolling forward funds on projects that were waiting to push forward. And so what I'm really excited about with this council that we're going to have is there's a real bias for action and getting things done. You heard it in the campaign. Projects are stagnant. How do we push things over the line? How do we do 248 and the senior center and the 5 acres? I said that too. I think that's great. But we don't have a lot of muscle memory in Park City about making trade-offs when it comes to money. We've been really fortunate with our tax base. And and sometimes politically, it's been hard to move projects forward. So you have fund balances that have rolled forward. The more we do, the more it's going to force this council to make, say, what are our priorities? What do we want to do? Of course, we're going to get creative. We want to do it all. But we need to have a really robust capital discussion as part of the budget and figure out how we're going to move this stuff forward.
Okay, you heard from, I think you approved the supplemental Sundance plan last night as well, is that right?
We did, it's going to look really similar to prior years. They're activating the Doubletree as a theater again. Still nothing at the Egyptian. They may have, or I guess it's the first time, nothing at the Egyptian. you know, some new sponsors. You know, Kettle One's on board, so I guess it'll be a great week to drink vodka. You know, but fundamentally, it'll be about the same festival.
Anything else that listeners need to hear about in terms of changes to traffic patterns, or is it basically the same things we saw last year to the traffic and parking?
It's really the same thing. It worked pretty well last year. We talked about parking, on that. We see that big first weekend, and then things seem to drop off, and sometimes residents get frustrated. It feels like it's hard to park and get to Old Town when it feels a little more empty. So that Tuesday of Sundance, parking and the streets will return back to normal. The street will reopen, and we can get back to Main Street.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. With the Egyptian not a venue, there's really nothing here for Sundance, right, except for the commercial, like the tents, like the I guess there's a car dealer, a car manufacturer that has a big tent here. And
Yeah. Basically, it's a sponsor set up, and of course, Main Street is a great party at Sundance.
That's
time,
what it is.
So we have
the
bars and the restaurants, and with the street, I thought it was great with the street closed.
It was fun
last year. It was fun. You know, it's a challenge for some of our businesses, but it was fun. Right? I know we're still working on how to create some activations at the top of the street to get people up there for those businesses.
So I guess that's a trade-off. If it's only for the first weekend, the businesses there will be traffic again on Tuesday.
Yeah, traffic again on Tuesday. Okay. The thing we want to work on, and that Sundance wants to be a good partner on, is you had people walking up the street saying, wow, isn't this great? And they kind of get to the area where the bars are and there's music playing, and they sort of get stuck and stop. And it was empty at the top of the street we had a DJ up there. Things were going on. So we got to just think about those businesses in our Sundance planning.
Before we went on the air, we were talking about a tunnel. Was that something that was discussed last night?
Yes, the infamous Snow Creek Tunnel. So still on our radar, this is the tunnel that goes from Snow Creek Drive over to, it's sort of from the market side to the Doubletree side, a tunnel under Kearns Boulevard. This is the last piece that was recommended by our walkability committee coming out of that 2007 walkability bond. So this has been talked about for a long time. We gave direction to move forward with a design contract for the tunnel to look at. It's two options for the tunnel. One for a hawk. This is an above grade crossing like the one on 224 by Fresh Market that always makes me a little nervous when we have visitors who don't know how that works, but it's an option. It's a lot cheaper, a lot faster.
It is a lot cheaper, yeah.
So I think, a piece of that design contract will create a set of alternatives that'll come back to council to say, hey, are we doing this tunnel? And then they'll continue forward and actually design it and do it. And if we do that by 2008, we'll have that complete Dans to Jans, pedestrian or walkability, rideability, trail piece that doesn't require you to, run across traffic and risk your life. So it's exciting stuff, but it's hard and it's expensive. So
and like a longtime parka, you just changed your reference to the market to Dan. So we are talking about a tunnel that would go between the market and the Yarrow.
The market, not to be confused with Fresh Market. Keep it straightforward.
Okay. Once again, 248 comes up, and last night I think was just approval of moving a report forward. Is that basically what happened?
Yeah, really just a communication to the council to let us know where we are and some information. So we've gone through. So big picture, we're looking at the 248 corridor to create a plan that meets the requirements for funding from UDOT and the federal government and FTA and probably some appropriations beyond that. So you've seen us, it's a funnel and sort of narrow the funnel through these screenings over time. We had this alternatives analysis and a level one screening, level two screening to narrow down to these three options that I'll be, be pretty shocked if we don't end up with bus rapid transit on 248 and we're out looking for funding for that. Not to get in front of the answer, but you see these alternatives, that's probably where we're headed. But we have to do these studies and we have to do it in a way that's compliant with UDOT standards. We're doing this study with UDOT. We are, hand in glove with them to make sure this meets all the requirements for funding at the end. Also in a way that's compliant with FTA, which has a whole different process. So we're trying to meet both the needs at the same time. And so we're gonna come back with the actual, these actual alternatives and the scoring methodology. Last night was about the scoring. In January, we'll have a work session on the 8th, and then in our regular meeting on the 20th, take action to move it forward. I think This is probably the biggest project we have in front of us that we can really leverage the Olympics to hopefully drive forward. This is how you get millions of people into town in a way that today is a challenge and can be addressed and hop on sort of this Olympics train to get a priority.
So it's interesting because 248 is a state road. So here it is, the entrance to the city where you guys have, the city clearly has a vital interest in it, but you're trying to triangulate between, I guess, three jurisdictions in terms of getting something that actually works, which sounds kind of hard to me, but
That's right. It's thorny, and that's why you got to make sure you've looked at all the alternatives.
Is that part of why you have to go? I mean, I know people are frustrated. Why haven't we figured something out yet? But is part of what takes so long is you want to make sure that none of the bureaucracies that you're going to look for money, right, can say, oh, you didn't do it this way, which we need you to have done.
That's right. The study has to be completed for FTA in a way that allows us to go right into NEPA, into the environmental review, and you have to do it in a certain way. So even if it seems obvious to us as residents of what we need to do on that corridor, you have to do the studies. And we've heard loud and clear from UDOT, from our meetings with our listening session that we had with Brad Wilson, the CEO of the Olympics, very clearly saying, we want to help you. Tell us your plan. And we're able to say, great, we're working on it, and we're going to have our plan very soon. That's what's going to come out of January 20th. And then we can ask for help, and I think we're going to get that help. So we are, when we talk about Olympics planning, there's always the question, hey, are we behind? And I continue to try to point out to people, we are still on the 2002 timeline. Right. The games hadn't been awarded for two more years. So we are out in front, we don't have to build venues, and we're already doing this work, which is, in some sense, Olympics planning. So we're in good shape.
Are any sort of experiments on the horizon? And by that, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about something like reversible lanes, where you could just run an experiment to see how that worked. How would that interplay with all these jurisdictions that we're talking about?
Yeah, so reversible lanes are part of this study, and okay. It's really looking at it as reversible transit lanes. So that's how
transit. Okay.
Yeah, people ask us, well, you can have these buses. That's great, but they just get stuck in traffic like everyone else. So if you have reversible lanes for transit, it's just another incentive for folks driving in, making that decision: am I going to pull off into this capture lot, which we need to build, and by the way, is part of the study, or am I just going to brave the traffic and hope to find a spot? So having a bus that flies by traffic is yet another incentive to get out of your car.
And of course, you mentioned the capture lot, because the only way this whole thing actually does what you want it to do is to have a capture lot. Are we still looking at the two alternatives for the capture lot?
Yeah, still the two alternatives, or a combination of both, which I think is also a likely outcome. And this study is going to tee up the decision of how to do that, whether to build that lot at Gordo, whether to do what it takes to expand our parking Richardson. In Richardson Flat. You know, those are really the two places we can do it.
And timeline, Ryan, I mean, I know this is hard to do, but I suspect this is going to be the biggest project of your administration. When do you think I'm not asking when they're going to actually, when we'll start seeing buses or movement, but when do you think a decision will be finalized?
Well, I hope we're going to make that decision on January 20th. Okay. You know, we'll see what comes back, but I've been, I think I told you before, I've been very careful about these first 100 days that everyone likes to talk about. But this is something that I said, yes, first 100 days that we need a decision on what we're doing here so that we can move it forward.
And then when you make that decision, then it goes back to UDOT?
Then it will complete the study. Right. It'll go back to UDOT. It's things we can bring to FTA. There's more work to do. We have to go into NEPA. Mm-hmm. But once you have a goal, it's really very similar to what happened on 224 with bus mm-hmm. rapid transit, with High Valley Transit in Summit County and a little bit of Park City. We're sort of following in their wake. It's all the same work. You get to the end. It's slow. It's grinding. It's competitive. But we will get this done.
Okay, Ryan, anything else you want to touch on before I let you go?
Well, I think the most exciting thing that happened last night was we swore in a brand new officer who happens to be a canine, Bruno, the chocolate lab. Bruno, I'm proud to say, it was the valedictorian of his class that he went through with one of our officers. So he's a very bright, talented canine and very cute as well, Roger. I can safely report. And so this is our first canine officer. Oh. Can already detect 20 explosive substances. His name was selected by a fifth grade class at McPolin Elementary. I think coming out of the We Don't Talk About Bruno. So very fun to have all the kids in the chambers and Bruno the dog. So that was a light and fun moment for us.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
All right. Thank you.
In the studio, I've got Gordy Scheer. He is the Director of Marketing and Sponsorship for, I guess it's USA Luge, or is that the right term?
That's right, USA Luge.
So there may be a lot of snow, may not be a lot of snow for skiing this weekend, but understand there's going to be some serious sliding out at the Utah Olympic Park. What do we got going on this weekend, Gordy?
Yeah, we have the Ebersprocher World Cup taking place today and tomorrow, and we'll be competing in a number of disciplines. That would be men's singles, women's singles, men's doubles, and for the first time, getting ready to make its Olympic debut is women's doubles. And then finally, we have a team relay event taking place on Saturday.
Okay, and how many, this is a World Cup event, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so how many countries will be represented in this one?
I think we have 24, and I think we're up to 120-something athletes.
120-something athletes, wow. Is that a big field?
It's an Olympic year, so you're always going to see everybody's trying to qualify for those Olympic spots.
And have they been doing training this week? Have people been up on the hill?
Yeah, they have. Training began on Tuesday, mm-hmm. and it's been a challenging week. The ice, the Park City is a challenging track, and there's been a bit of an adjustment period. Everybody's trying to figure out how it's built and how it's going to work. So yeah, it's exciting, but training's going well.
You know, with these ridiculous 50 degree temperatures here, how is that affecting the ice?
It makes it difficult. Park City's got a great track crew, and it certainly places a big burden on those guys and girls to make sure that the ice is in shape. But so thankfully the track is refrigerated.
Well, I assume. I don't know. But let me ask you a question. Can you sort of compare the times you're seeing in this week's training to historical times? In other words, is there a material slowing as a result of this weather?
Yeah.
I think there would have to be, right?
Yeah, it's okay. Never going to be as fast as ideal luge weather is like 10 degrees, zero, like very low humidity and sunny. That's ideal luge weather. That's where you're going to see the fastest times. But there's an anomaly here in the Park City track. And that is that the records which were set, way back when, pretty much still stand from, those records, that ice that was here during the Olympic Games.
During the Olympics,
so really spectacular.
I stood out in the cold during those Olympics 20 some odd years ago, and it was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that... because this is an Olympic year, it probably affected the quality of the field. Is that right?
Well, the size.
The size, right.
Yeah. So we're going to have a lot of athletes, and that's great. That's when you really get to see. And I should also add that this is one of five Olympic qualifying events. And there was the World Cup. There was supposed to be a World Cup in Austria that got canceled.
Because of the weather?
No. They did some modifications to the lower portion of the track, and perhaps in one of the most un-Austrian things that's ever happened, the design just wasn't right.
Whoa.
So, what they wound up doing was that first World Cup was meant to be a qualifying race. So they had a test event in Cortina, mm-hmm. which then assumed the role of qualifying race, and then that World Cup, which was supposed to be in Austria, got moved to Germany, and it lost its qualify. It was no longer a qualifying race, so things are a little bit jumbled around.
Let's try to explain that for people who are sort of interested in the Olympics but don't get it.
Yeah.
Talk to us about what a qualifying event is and what this event will mean.
Yeah, sure. So there's no set number of sleds per nation. First of all,
that's interesting.
So what will happen is each nation's got to earn spots into that Olympic field. And right now, in all likelihood, you're looking at two women, two men, one or two men's doubles, and then probably one Well, in all likelihood, one women's doubles, because the women's doubles field is relatively small to the rest of the field. But so first you got to earn, say we're trying to earn sleds, and then those sleds will be occupied by individual athletes who earn those qualifications.
All right, so let me see if I got this straight.
It's complicated.
You're here to help us understand. Okay, so does the Olympic Committee say we're going to have a total of 30 sleds?
Yeah, there's a set number of sleds. Okay. And the interesting thing is we were awarded women's doubles, but the field size stayed the same. So it makes qualifying for all disciplines a lot harder.
Yeah. Okay, so, we've sort of been sitting here assuming people know what a luge looks like. Let's take a step back. What is a luge?
Sure. It is a sliding sport that takes place on the same track as bobsled, and you go down feet first, and you're steering with your shoulders and your feet. There is singles, and there is doubles. And speeds in excess of 90 miles an hour, and we are the fastest sport on ice.
It's faster than the bobsled?
Yes.
And you know, how old are the athletes typically?
You're going to see athletes usually in peak form in their early 30s.
Early
30s, late 20s. You know, it's fairly typical. You've got that. It's an experience-based sport. So,
okay.
But it's also a sport where you need explosive power at the start. So you kind of reach that point where you may see a diminishing peak. You know, you're no longer in peak physical form, but your experience in driving the sled it really becomes valuable. But then at some point, you know, everything just starts to slide off, just like any other sport. You know, you have your outliers. You've got your Brett Favres of the world in luge.
And are there any Americans competing that are, for lack of a better term, relatively old this time?
No, we've got some athletes who are in their early 30s, but that's the oldest that we have on our team.
So now, what are some of the athletes whose performances we should be looking to read about on Monday or Tuesday?
Sure. Well, first of all, you should go to the race and not read about it.
Okay, well, let's stop. Before we go further, when are the races and what does it cost to go?
It's free, and they're at the Utah Olympic Park, and racing begins today at 3 o'clock, and we've got men's singles first run, women's singles first run, and then we're going to have men and women doubles. And then tomorrow, on Saturday, at 4:15, we're going to have the final of the two runs for men and women singles, and that's going to begin at 4:15. And then we have the team relay.
How does that work?
Oh, it's amazing. It's definitely, this is the event to watch. So each team sends one man, one woman, one men's doubles, and one women's doubles. And the first sled off of the hill is the woman, and she's sitting in front of a gate. That gate opens. She goes down the hill. You pass the traditional finish line, and hanging over the track is a pad. The athlete sits up, strikes the pad, which opens the gate. And so, yeah. So you keep going until the last sled down, and then the last sled hits that pad, the clock stops, lowest combined time wins. What's really interesting is that each team has their strengths and weaknesses. So you may see that they're in the lead and then they lose it, and then another sled comes back and gains it. Then you also have athletes who have very quick reaction times, because obviously you're adding the reaction time when that gate opens. It now becomes a part of the equation.
So the gate opens and then you start sprinting, right?
Okay. Well, you're sitting on two handles, and you pull off from those two handles. It's luge. It's not like bobsled where you're running.
Okay.
Yeah. So that gate opens and then you have that reaction time, which also becomes an element in this whole, you know, time equation.
Okay, and for those who have never gone before, help us where's the best place to stand? How do you best get a sense of everything that's going on, which I know is a challenge in a sport like this?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Utah Olympic Park has, first of all, they have monitors. They have large screens so you can watch the race, which is great. And you'll be surprised how close you can actually get to the track. I mean, you can stand and just look right into the track and be very surprisingly close. And when the sleds go by, the sensation of speed it's breathtaking. It's really, really cool. And there's a lot of access all over the track. You can walk right from the bottom up to the top. Mm-hmm. So really great vantage points all over.
So you can stand, basically, you'll stand by the side of the track, essentially, yep. and watch them go whizzing by.
Yep.
But I can also look up at a monitor so I can see.
Yes.
I know when they're coming. And this seems like a spectator sport that would greatly benefit from those two sort of feeds, for lack of a better term, the actual feed and the television feed.
Absolutely, yeah. Plus, you can see the clock and understand who's in the lead and who's behind and get a better picture of the whole race. But the other thing that I should add is that there is some entertainment stuff down at the bottom of the park. They've got some axe throwing. They've got some face painting. They've got a warm-up area. So there's going to be a lot of fun stuff to do. And So it's family fun.
Okay. And if I were to go to the Las Vegas book and ask them who the favorites were this weekend, if they had detailed information, which they probably don't, what would I hear?
The traditional powerhouse is the German team.
Yeah.
And the Austrians are coming on very, very strong right now. But this is a home race for the U.S. athletes. And the last time the U.S. athletes raced, the doubles team of Marcus Mueller and Ansel Hogshaw, they were second in the men's doubles race. But from a Park City perspective, we've got Ashley Farquharson. And Ashley finished fourth in that test race in Cortina and has finished, I mean, she's always a favorite for a medal, and it'll be interesting to see what she can do in her home track. We've got also other Park City residents competing that I must mention, and one is Emma Erickson, and women's singles, Matt Greiner, who's a two-time junior world championship medalist.
All right, Gordy, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Coming up, the community campfire will be here. Amber Johnson visits with Heber's own Mr. and Mrs. Claus, Jeff and Tammy Gray, and their masterclass in holiday magic and joy. And then come behind the mic with one of our very own KPCW DJs, and Coach Skinner will have Skinny on Sports.